It seems Pinker is neglecting the fact that evolution seems to actually favour cheating, suggesting that, for survival fitness, the mated members of our species need not be, and often are not, immune to calculations about finding a better lover. This line of reasoning could lead to a powerful objection against Pinker's argument. It would require a good deal more research and elaboration to be completely convincing. We have said enough, however, for the purpose of illustration. The important point to appreciate at this juncture is that even the most powerful objection against an argument is dubious if the author is not allowed to respond. After working out the best attack on the author you can muster, always pause to consider how the author would respond before proceeding to the final stage of your paper. Sometimes when you do this, you'll find the author has such a good response that your objection begins to look like an instance of straw man. In that case, it will be wise to go back to the drawing board and develop a different objection. Other times, in searching for the author's response, you may discover something new that takes the debate to a deeper level. Notice how our objection raises a concrete counterexample to premise 9. Our objection aims to show that the widespread phenomenon of adultery proves romantic love should not make human beings immune to calculations about finding a better lover. It might be tempting for Pinker to ignore this counterexample, generating a different example in support of his thesis instead. For instance, he might argue that religion could provide another way to make human beings immune to calculations about finding another lover. Religion is a common denominator among human beings in every corner of the globe, and has been since the dawn of civilization. Although religions are different, most glorify faithfulness in marriage and punish sexual transgressions. While religion could become relevant to this discussion at some stage, it would be a mistake for Pinker to use it as a response to the adultery objection. Fighting one example with a different example is a version of the red herring fallacy, because the effect is to change the subject. Changing the subject in this way is a very common error in a position paper, and critical thinkers must avoid it at all costs. There is already an objection on the table. Pinker must respond to that very objection, or we will be inclined to suspect it has him beat. So, what would Pinker say about the adultery example? It seems his best bet would be to clarify what he meant by commitment. A man might feel deeply committed to his family unit, even while sowing wild oats with the 10 out of 10 who moved in next door. By defining commitment loosely, Pinker can consistently concede that human beings are prone to cheating. After all, what cheating means is that the person wants to retain the original relationship while at the same time getting extra on the side. Pinker's point is that the desire to retain the original relationship is enforced by the deeply irrational emotional attachment of romantic love. Pinker would pose the question, why do human beings bother to cheat when they could simply walk out? His theory provides an answer. Heartstrings pull them back, even if going back defies all rational calculation. Of course, humans sometimes do dump one partner in favor of a higher-ranking alternative. But notice that in such cases, people often say, she never really loved him, or he was just using her all along. This suggests that true cases of romantic love prevent or at least strongly deter dumping, even while they permit cheating. In order to complete our defense of Pinker, it would be best to find some concrete empirical evidence for our claims. We may also want to read other things Pinker has written for clues to how he might defend himself. For present purposes, however, we shall pass on to the final stage of the paper. Resolution. Once you have exhausted your resources for objection and response, you are in a position to make an intelligent determination of your own on the question. Only after you have examined both sides with an open mind will you be able to make a worthwhile contribution to the debate. Which side do you ultimately find the most compelling and why? Or have you found that both sides have problems that a third possibility might solve? Don't think of the resolution section of your paper as your concluding paragraph. You should add a brief summary conclusion after the resolution section of your paper. The resolution is not a throwaway afterthought in which to reveal a bias. On the contrary, it is the most important section of the paper. Its raison d'être. The explanation, the reconstruction, the objection, and the response to the objection all lead up to the moment when you finally make your case for your own view. This means not just stating an opinion, but making an argument. You need to present a clear proposal with reasons to support it. To put yourself in the right frame of mind, you may want to try plugging your ideas into a standard form. As you no doubt realize by now, the standard form is just a device for setting your logic straight. When it comes time for you to make your case at a meeting or in class, you shouldn't need it. It will have done its job by then and will help you express yourself effectively. What is your view of romantic love? We leave it to you to finish this paper on your own. Exercises. Try your hand at writing a position paper on the following selections. Start with an explanation of the issue. This will involve reading the selection several times and defining key terms. Next, reconstruct the author's argument in valid standard form. Then select the premise you find most controversial for an objection and a response. When you feel you have fully examined both sides of the issue, make a case for your own view. Finally, add a brief introduction and a brief conclusion. Law. H.H. Coe. Opening remarks, Transnational Legal Processes Illuminated. In Michael Lykowski, Transnational Legal Processes, Globalization and Power Disparities. As an international human rights lawyer and academic who has only recently returned from Washington, I find that for many political actors, including in the Washington political environment, rules of international law are more nuisance than guide. There definitely is a strong and discernible impulse to subordinate law to power and lawyers to their political clients. But if there is one lesson that I have learned, it is that the transnational legal process of norm internalization is not self-activating. If international relations are to be more than just power politics, international lawyers must serve as moral actors who seek self-consciously to promote this process of norm internalization. It is the job of international lawyers to promote international norms, to identify legal constraints, and to identify ways to channel proposed state actions into normative frameworks. By doing so, public international lawyers help shape policy decisions, which in turn shape legal instruments, which in time become internalized into bureaucratic decision-making processes that promote national compliance with international norms. By so doing, international lawyers who work in the public interest can influence policy and help influence the development of transnational public law. Anthropology. Marvin Harris, The Abominable Pig, in Carol Cunahan and Penny Van Esterick's Food and Culture, a Reader. The pig had been domesticated for one purpose only, namely to supply meat. As ecological conditions became unfavorable for pig raising, there was no alternative function which could redeem its existence. The creature became not only useless, but worse than useless, harmful, a curse to touch or merely to see, a pariah animal. In this perspective, the fact that pig raising remained possible for the Israelites at low cost in certain remnant hillside forests of swampy habitats, or at extra expense where shade and water were scarce, does not contradict the ecological basis of the taboo. If there had not been some minimum possibility of raising pigs, there would have been no reason to taboo the practice. As the history of Hindu cow protection shows, religions gain strength when they help people make decisions which are in accord with pre-existing useful practices, but which are not so completely self-evident as to preclude doubts and temptations. To judge from the Eightfold Way or the Ten Commandments, God does not usually waste time prohibiting the impossible or condemning the unthinkable. If the Israelites had been alone in their interdictions of pork, I would find it more difficult to choose among alternative explanations of the pig taboo. The recurrence of pig aversions in several different Middle Eastern cultures strongly supports the view that the Israelite ban was a response to recurrent practical conditions, rather than to a set of beliefs peculiar to one religion's notions about clean and unclean animals. At least three other important Middle Eastern civilizations, the Phoenicians, Egyptians, and Babylonians, were as disturbed by pigs as were the Israelites. Philosophy. Mark Tanzer on Existentialism. The existentialist's turn away from abstract principles is often taken to imply that there are no such principles proper to existentialist thought. If this were the case, then the only accurate way to explain existentialist thought would be to recount the descriptions of concrete life found in the works of existentialist authors, along with the technical terminology used in these descriptions. And, in fact, existentialist authors dedicate a great deal of their writings to the explication of such concrete details. Hence the apparent propriety of focusing a supplemental study on these details, and this is the approach that such studies typically take. The result, however, is usually a welter of statements about the complexity of everyday life, about the difficulties intrinsic to concrete human existence, along with loosely connected discussions of the vast array of technical terms employed by existentialist authors to describe these phenomena. In this way, the reader is given the impression that the disunity suffered by supplemental studies that take this approach is inherent in existentialist thought itself. Existentialism seems to be composed of a loosely connected group of writers, without any principles to tie them together. Moreover, this characterization promotes a stereotypical view of existentialism that has cast suspicion on its properly philosophical character, on the extent to which existentialist philosophy is really a philosophy at all. The stereotypical view is that existentialist authors eschew the entire apparatus of traditional philosophical analysis by refusing to ground their claims about the nature of the world and of the human being in underlying principles. Instead, existentialists are seen as promulgating their own peculiar idiosyncratic views of the world, which are based on their parochial observations of the human condition, views that are then presented to their readers through a fog of obscure technical terminology. By grounding existentialist thought in the basic principle of the indeterminacy of all that exists, and by deriving from this principle the specific doctrines regarding the nature of the world and of the human being held by existentialist philosophers, we hope to give a unified picture of the existentialist movement and to take a step toward overcoming the stereotypical view of existentialism. Conclusion. He who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that. John Stuart Mill. Your mind is your most valuable asset. Critical thinking is the only way to take advantage of its ability to lead you to the truth. In a free society where everyone has the right to believe and say almost anything they please, it is easy to lose sight of the importance of the truth. After all, the truth is often rather unpleasant. Why should we work so hard at trying to find it? If you're not actively working at discovering the truth every time you think about an issue, then there's a very good chance you believe falsehoods. This should alarm you. It's counterproductive and even dangerous to tote falsehoods around in your mind, because they can cause you to take the wrong action. A simple example: suppose someone believes illness is caused by demons rather than germs. After he uses a public restroom, he whispers an incantation against the demons instead of washing his hands to remove the germs. Not surprisingly, this person has a tendency to catch colds a lot and to spread them to his family and friends. If he thought critically about his demon belief and discovered the truth, he could avoid this unfortunate state of affairs. Very few people believe in demons anymore, but don't kid yourself into thinking you're free of false beliefs. Notice that the saddest thing about our demon guy is that, even after getting sick, he'll never realize the true cause. He'll simply assume he forgot to say the right incantation at the right time. People who don't take critical thinking seriously are just like the demon guy. They find themselves miserable and they don't know why. They keep making the same mistakes over and over again, never getting to the truth of the matter. Critical thinking cannot promise you a happy life. It can't even promise to reveal the truth, but it can promise to be much more conducive to both of these things than the alternative. John Stuart Mill was a great 19th century English philosopher who not only wrote important and influential theories about how human beings can improve their lives, but also put these theories into practice as a member of parliament and political activist. In an inaugural address to the University of St. Andrews, he presented what may be the best rallying cry for logic ever written. It is worth quoting him in full. "Of logic, I venture to say, even if limited to that of mere ratiocination, the theory of names, propositions, and the syllogism, that there is no part of intellectual education which is of greater value, or whose place can so ill be supplied by anything else. Its uses, it is true, are chiefly negative. Its function is not so much to teach us to go right, as to keep us from going wrong. But in the operations of the intellect, it is so much easier to go wrong than right. It is so utterly impossible for even the most vigorous mind to keep itself in the path but by maintaining a vigilant watch against all deviations, and noting all the byways by which it is possible to go astray, that the chief difference between one reasoner and another consists in their less or greater liability to be misled.